Tautologies. For Appaloosa Radio, C, therefore A equals C, and it works backwards. C equals A, B equals C, therefore A equals B. Many years ago, in my very first philosophy course, our instructor invited an eminent logician to speak to our class. To be sure, he spoke more to the chalkboard than he did to us, but I still remember some of his talk, particularly his emphasis that all of logic is a tautology. I don't think I had ever heard the word tautology before. Not really a common word, certainly not a common concept. The logician said, "A statement is always true because it describes all logical possibilities. Always true." All logical possibilities. Strange ideas. In my dorm room, I asked myself, how do you know whether something is always true or whether it describes all logical possibilities? Well, for the logician, the answer was easy. A statement was tautologically true because of its logical properties, or as he said, its logical structure. Its content did not matter. It could be about anything. However, its logical structure did matter. It was the logical structure that made the statement true. In later philosophy classes, I learned more about formal systems of logic, or as the course syllabi noted, symbolic representation of logical properties. To most people, symbolic logic would appear to be a version of mathematics, since it only used symbols, for example, variables, and the so-called operators like conjunction and, disjunction, or, negation, not, and implication, if, then. In our symbolic logic courses, we also spent much of our energy doing mathematical style proofs. Given this, say, X, prove this, Y, follows from it. Most importantly, I learned that a formal system was true because it was defined to be true. A friend of mine expressed the opinion that formal logic was analogous to a crossword puzzle. Someone created boxes, and then you had to fit letters into the boxes. Personally, I feel a better analogy is the popular game of Sudoku. There are rules for the game that must be followed. Why are the rules true? Well, whoever invented the game made the rules. The inventor had defined the rules to be true. That was what the eminent logician was talking about. Someone had defined a system which followed certain rules. If the rules were followed, then you get results like if A equals B, and if B equals C, then A equals C. Always the same results in every possible world. The result is true because the rules were followed. Logicians would say that such a formal, logical system was tautological. I share this meander about tautologies because I have been thinking a lot about something I read in a magazine. I had read Brainwave Spike During Death. Researchers found that in the process of dying, brain activity increases. When it is graphed, it represents a distinct series of sharp, upward spikes. Before these spikes, there is usually a period of low-level dormancy, typically a relatively flat line of limited brain activity. Then, during death, brainwave activity spikes. Now, one of the most common tautologies used in logic classes is of the form, either X or not X. This tautology must be true because it refers to both an event, situation, occurrence, statement, and its negation. It covers all the possibilities. In the context of if A is B and if B is C, then A is C. I want to ask about one specific tautology. I am either dead or I am not dead. This tautology is, according to logicians, true by virtue of its logical form. It is true in all possible worlds. One or the other option must be true. Hence, the entire statement is true. But is it? I think not. I am not talking about the zombie undead stuff that you see in some movies. No, I am speaking about recent research into the nature of consciousness. Consciousness, what I choose to call the I am. The best place to begin this discussion is with René Descartes, who wrote seminal works in mathematics and philosophy during the early 17th century. Descartes was an incredible mathematician who was also a devoted Roman Catholic. He was a pioneer in modern algebra and analytic geometry. He firmly believed that mathematics could be used as a primary tool to investigate the natural world. Natural phenomena could be quantified, aggregated, and measured. Furthermore, the rigor of mathematics provided certainty that simple observation did not. Descartes wanted to provide the same level of certainty about his religious faith. He began a series of rigorous thought exercises which led him to the conclusion that he is most remembered for. He asked what could be doubted, what lacked certainty. He found most of what he believed was not certain. Then he reached his most fundamental realization. I can doubt everything except for the fact that I am now doubting. In logical form, he concluded, I am doubting, therefore, I am. This conclusion, he wrote, was tautological. It was true because of its logical structure. It is true in all possible worlds. The fact that I am doubting means I must be. I can guarantee the reality of nothing else, he said, but I can guarantee that there is a me who is at this moment thinking about itself. He believed that there was a conscious self whose existence cannot be doubted. Neuroscientists now agree that the evidence for a conscious self is very well documented. They have been studying human brains in CAT scans, or MRI studies, for nearly four decades. While in the scanner, they have asked subjects to perform math problems, smell perfume, watch films, write poetry, read a novel. Many hundreds of such tasks. They now know that the operational center for consciousness is located in the posterior cerebral cortex portion of the brain. This finding has been confirmed both in humans and in mammals. There is no doubt that consciousness is real, measurable, and well-researched. However, there is still considerable discussion about what it is, or more precisely, what mental phenomena it includes. There is no doubt that consciousness is real, measurable, and well-researched. It is a demonstrable phenomenon available for scientific study. In that way, it is like the stars in the cosmos or the shifting tectonic plates of the Earth's geology. Nonetheless, there is still considerable discussion about what it is, or more precisely, what mental phenomena it includes. At a minimum, researchers agree that consciousness involves being aware of and being responsive to an individual's environmental surroundings. In fact, many researchers identify it as being aware, or more precisely, being alert to. In earlier research, scientists asked the individual to verbally describe what they were encountering. An accurate verbal report ensured that the individual was indeed cognizant of the stimuli. Now, most of the neurological studies conducted using CAT scans and similar equipment accept responsiveness of the cerebral cortex as evidence of consciousness. That allows for studies when the subject is sleeping or under anesthesia. In addition to being aware of and responsive to one's surroundings, consciousness is now regarded as including any thought or experience or feeling or sensation that a person may have. That means consciousness includes not only the posterior cerebral cortex, but many other parts of the brain as well. Many studies now ask about the direction of the flow of neural activity. That is, whether the posterior cerebral cortex begins a neural sequence of brain events, or whether a sequence of brain events terminates at the posterior cerebral cortex. An event that terminates at the posterior cerebral cortex is assumed to inform it, to give it information on which it can act. A while ago, psychology researchers used to ask whether a person was aware that they are aware. Reflection about one's own thinking, Unfortunately, that proved to be a much rarer event than the early psychologists had believed. How often do you think about your own thinking? Have you ever done so? Thinking about one's own thinking was long a staple of Freudian theorists. It was also a staple element for many contemporary fiction writers. But neuroscience has moved on from those now dated notions. Another approach that has been discarded is the study of the subjective quality of experiences. There has been a long philosophical tradition that focuses on the so-called qualia of consciousness, the subjective internal perceptions of an experience. How does the flower smell to you? Or what does this painting mean to you? The simple truth is that the qualia that different individuals experience are far too subjective for careful scientific study. Finally, there is now little concern among today's neuroscientists about the so-called stream of consciousness. That is, how a series of experiences are linked together into a seeming totality. Again, the terrain is too subjective to provide solid footing. Still, there is lots for neuroscience to study. Being aware of and responsive to one's surroundings. Problem-solution thinking, experiencing a feeling or sensation. Information flow, decision-making, and not only the posterior cerebral cortex, but many other parts of the brain as well. Returning to René Descartes, who believed, you may remember, that there was a conscious self whose existence cannot be doubted, he formulated what he claimed was a logical tautology, a statement which is true in all possible worlds. You may remember that he concluded, "I am now doubting, therefore I am." He claimed this was a logical tautology because "I am" equals "I am." The first statement is simply repeated in the last part of it. A logician would claim that the statement only says that an object is identical to itself. That seems pretty tautological. Not much to argue about. But Descartes was not interested in such a simple conclusion. He had engaged in his thought exercise to prove something more. He was a man of strong religious faith, and he believed that his logical tautology proved the existence of the eternal soul. He had said that his original tautology was, "I am now doubting, therefore I am." But what he really meant was, "I am doubting, therefore I am a being with an eternal soul." His claim was that consciousness is a non-material, spiritual, an eternal component of a human placed in them by God. Consciousness is an irreducible experience whose contents cannot be separated or altered or reduced to other phenomena. Its experiences are unified wholes, a complete tapestry, as Descartes would say. As a devout Roman Catholic, he believed our individual consciousness represented God's omni-consciousness. God's consciousness has no limits. Ours, on the other hand, is limited. We are finite creatures with a limited lifespan and possess only partial knowledge. Still, our personal consciousness represents God's. Ours is a more limited model of His. It should not be surprising that Descartes denied that animals could reason, nor could they show intelligence. To be sure, he observed, animals experience the world. They saw, smelled, and touched things. They avoided predators, located food, and bore their young. However, all of those phenomena could easily be explained by natural means. Humans, on the other hand, felt joy, love, and alas, pain and suffering. That was because humans had an eternal soul where such qualities reside. Animals are subject to the law of tooth and claw, while humans carry the privilege of divine grace. In contrast, most theorists now believe that many animals, and maybe even some plants, also have a conscious self. In a major international conference held at Cambridge University in 2012, the participants drafted a signed document that concluded, "Convergent evidence indicates that non-human animals, including all mammals and birds and other creatures, have the necessary neural substrates of consciousness and the capacity to exhibit intentional behaviors. If consciousness means having the capacity to exhibit intentional behaviors, then having a conscious self is a widespread occurrence. Contemporary theorists point to pain, predator, avoidance strategies that animals develop from their experiences. Animals develop cognitive strategies that they selectively employ in specific situations to avoid pain and/or danger. The key to saying that some animals have consciousness lies in the fact that these animals apply these avoidance strategies selectively in some contexts, but not others. For example, some species of octopus change their coloration depending on which predator might be nearby. One type of coloration frightens one predator species, while another coloration frightens away another species. The individual animal chooses which strategy to use when. Recently, I had the opportunity to watch a video of Maestro Claudio Abbado conducting the Berlin Philharmonic in a performance of one of Dvorak's symphonies. I was surprised, contrary to many stereotypes, how little the conductor moved. No large arm gestures, no baton keeping a beat, no swirling body movements. No. Abbado communicated largely with facial expressions, an occasional small hand gesture which was barely noticeable. For large segments of this complicated score, he seemed to be doing nothing. Neuroscientists now believe that the posterior cerebral cortex acts in a similar way in relation to other parts of the brain, particularly the cerebellum. The cerebellum coordinates motor control and the ability to adjust to and interact with sensory-motor relationships. Sounds complex, but the basic idea is simple. The body uses its various sensory tools to explore and to encounter the world. Some sensory tools deal with hard and soft. Some deal with light and dark. Some deal with location, space. The cerebellum puts all these various sensory inputs together and decides that what I am encountering is a light switch on the wall of my room. The cerebellum also coordinates my motor actions, allowing me to flip the light switch on or off. What is unique about the cerebellum is that it has synaptic plasticity. Its wiring can be rewired again and again, many times. In other words, the neurons of the cerebellum can learn, and through learning, make adjustments to what the brain perceives. Last week, we installed a new ceiling fan in my office. Instead of just one switch, I now have two. One controls the fan, and the other controls the lights. Within minutes of installing the new switches, I knew which was which. My cerebellum had rewired itself to accommodate the new information. Now, when I come in and it is dark, I know which switch to flip to turn on the lights. Recent neurological studies have found that the cerebellum has at least two types of input cells. One set, called the Purkinje cells, seem to be the keepers of long-term information. These cells send many thousands of weak electrical signals, sort of like saying, "Here I am. Here's where that information is stored." A weak signal sent many thousands of times each hour, the Purkinje cells. The other type is termed the teaching signal. It is much stronger, kind of a jolt. It says, "Here is new information. Remember it." The cerebellum coordinates motor control and the transmission of sensory information. Walking, talking, swallowing, playing the piano. Any motor activity is largely controlled by the cerebellum. Its specialty is well-learned neural network patterns, something that someone has done many, many times. Moreover, because the neural network pattern is well-established, the cerebellum is quick. Input comes in, and motor instructions come back out seemingly instantly. A race car driver driving at a speed of 225 miles per hour can avoid obstacles and prevent a wreck because their cerebellum has well-established network neural sequences that respond quickly. A concert pianist can play a complex sonata without once asking, "Which key do I press next?" They have practiced so often that their cerebellum handles the information without sending it up to the other parts of the brain. To return to Claudio Abbado and the Berlin Philharmonic, the orchestra is like the cerebellum. Each member of the orchestra knows their instrument from thousands of hours of previous practice. They have also rehearsed the score multiple times. All they need to perform their part is the merest signal from the conductor. An eyebrow movement or a smile is all they require. The conductor, Maestro Abbado, is much like the posterior cerebral cortex. His job is to alert the various performers when to play, when to stop, how loud to play, and at what beat to play on. The members of the orchestra already know how to play. They need a conductor to play together as a unity. Let me repeat that in a slightly different way. The posterior cerebral cortex takes in information and then, using that information, tells each component when to do its part in order to act together as a unity, not randomly or chaotically, but together in unison. So, the posterior cerebral cortex is not always thinking. No, it is most often monitoring, attending to what is going on. When necessary, it alerts and gives instructions to the cerebellum and other parts of the brain. Several studies have shown that when the posterior cerebral cortex is given anesthesia, the rest of the brain becomes susceptible to random distractions and haphazard wave fluctuations. The researchers describe the brain as unstable. Its regularity is disturbed. Its actions are not predictable. Sort of a wild driver under the influence. Driving on the wrong side of the freeway, careening around corners, becoming a danger to others. Most particularly under anesthesia, it can no longer distinguish random noise from valid sensory inputs. The researchers posit that, like the conductor of an orchestra, the brain needs consciousness for its own stable, normal functioning. To eliminate random noise and process instead genuine information, in a word, like to be stable. Listening to Appaloosa Radio. This is an audio story titled Tautologies. Neuroscientists now have evidence that the posterior cerebral cortex acts like the conductor of a symphonic orchestra. It takes in information and then, using that information, tells each component of the brain when to do its part in order to act together as unity, not randomly or chaotically, but together in unison. Earlier we said that the cerebellum coordinates motor control. It takes in information, primarily through the brainstem, from the body's various sensory tools, and then uses this information to tell the body's various muscles how to move. The cerebellum is especially geared towards quick action, based on its well-rehearsed motor pattern. There is a large hill near my house. In my younger and more fit days, I enjoyed running up it. Moving my legs quick enough so that I did not fall flat on my face was largely left to the neural cells in my cerebellum. Also earlier, we said that neuroscientists have now discovered that the neural cells of the cerebellum are of two types. One type serves to store long-term information. Cells of this type are constantly sending out low-intensity electrical impulses, much like a buoy in a marine shipping channel. Don't come here. It is too shallow. Repeated over and over and over, neuroscientists now believe that by its frequent low-intensity electrical signal, these cells are constantly reminding the brain where information is stored. As I run up the hill, these cells are reminding my brain that there is a culvert on one side of the hill. Stay away. Don't get too close to it. The cerebellum's other type of neural cell, it is much stronger. Kind of a jolt, a strong, unique jolt of electricity. It seems to say, wake up. Here is new information. Remember it. These jolts are teaching the neural cells to replace older information with more recent information. As we said earlier, the cerebellum is specifically good at fast action. Action that may well be necessary for survival. Transmitting the various channels of sensory information and acting on it. Which brings us to a rephrase of Descartes' original conclusion, a more action-oriented approach, if you will. I want to do something, therefore I am. Under this alternative formulation, humans are viewed as volitional actors. They have things they want to do. The fact that I have a will to do things implies that there is an I am doing them. Some contemporary theorists have concluded that humans developed the function of consciousness as an evolutionary adaptation to make willful volitional action possible. Many eons ago, there was an organism with something it wanted to do. If I just could move a few more inches, I would get to the food source I need. I want to do something, therefore I am. That is, I want to do something, therefore I use components of my brain to make it happen. Particularly the cerebellum, which is so connected to the motion control. The corollary of this argument is that in adapting the ability to move, it became also necessary to create mechanisms to control that movement. My movement needs to be purposeful, goal-directed, focused. I need a conductor like Maestro Abbado. I need the posterior cerebral cortex to direct the orchestra. To be a successful predator, one needs to develop strategies and acquire the means for catching prey. And that, these theorists argue, is why consciousness developed. It is a function within the brain that guides movement in a purposeful direction. I know where I want to go. I know what I want to accomplish. So I generate the actions and the movements necessary to get there. Movement becomes volitional, and thus it becomes purposeful. My consciousness makes me one who acts purposefully. Willful, volitional action. I want to do something. I need to act in order to accomplish something. I need to coordinate each component when to do its part. I need the components to act together as a unity, not randomly or chaotically, but together in unison. So far, I have avoided the most vexing question. Granted that consciousness exists, what is it? There is one theory that I believe can be easily dismissed. Recently, I have seen a number of YouTube videos positing a unified collective consciousness. They say there are no individual minds. All minds are merged into one unified consciousness. There is no simple individual I am. No, we are all one. We are. Myself is fully contained within the collective self. The individual I am is a fiction. From the perspective of contemporary neuroscience, this is not a useful model. I think it can be dismissed with a simple thought exercise. First, pinch yourself hard so you feel pain. Now, pinch another person, also hard so they feel pain. The question is, do you feel the other person's pain? The answer is no. You feel your pain. The stimulus transmitted through your neurons to your brain. However, you do not directly and immediately feel the pain of another person. The stimulus is not transmitted through your own body's neurons. That is, my pain is mine and your pain is yours. For the purposes of contemporary neuroscience, there is no need to posit a collective consciousness into which all individual feelings and perceptions are merged. We are individuals. Our conscious activity is ours. We can eliminate this option. Still, one can ask, what is consciousness? The perpetual mind-body problem has been debated many times, going back at least as far as Aristotle. While there have been many theories about what consciousness is, I believe there are probably only three viable contemporary candidates. There is the theoretical view, most often called dualism. It is, of course, the position of René Descartes. Consciousness is a non-material, spiritual, and eternal component of a human placed in them by God. Consciousness is an irreducible experience whose contents cannot be separated or altered or reduced to other phenomena. Its experiences are unified wholes, a complete tapestry, as Descartes would say. As a devout Roman Catholic, he believed our individual consciousness represented God's omni-consciousness. God's consciousness has no limits. Ours, on the other hand, is limited. We are finite creatures with a limited lifespan and possess only partial knowledge. Still, our personal consciousness represents God's. Ours is a smaller model of his. This classic position is often called dualism. The mind and the body are separate but tightly conjoined entities. But one cannot be reduced to the other. A direct corollary of this position is that consciousness can be experienced but not empirically studied. A second theoretical model is based on an analogy to the information processing procedures in contemporary computers. It is currently the most common position among neuroscience researchers. Consciousness is viewed as the result of complex electromagnetic networks organized into hierarchical structures. By hierarchical structures, they mean what computer programmers call decision trees, a series of statements of the form, if A is true, then go to procedure B. If A is false, then go to procedure C. When computer codes are organized into decision trees, computers can be programmed to perform quite complex tasks, each decision building on earlier decisions. This position says that when an electromagnetic network gets to be sufficiently complex, on the order of many billions of individual components, it develops a cohesion and unity that we perceive as consciousness. An important iteration of this model is the so-called neural correlates of consciousness hypothesis, abbreviated NCC. This hypothesis developed from earlier studies of visual perception, particularly studies that asked how strong, intense, does a stimulus have to be before a person reports they see it. In the most simply terms, these studies found that for a novel, new stimuli, more neurons were involved in coming to recognize it than with an older familiar stimuli. Not only were more neurons triggered for novel stimuli, but these triggered neurons were higher up what the researchers viewed as a decision tree. It was a process very similar to what computer programmers do with computers. They develop decision tree sequences in their program. For example, is the object yellow? If yes, then go to sequence 756. If no, go to sequence 442. Now, is it round? Using the NCC hypothesis, researchers investigated the minimal set of neural events necessary for someone to say definitely that they saw the stimulus object, and they also measured the path of the flow of by which that recognition sequence traveled. So they came to understand how the brain comes to recognize something that was not familiar. It does so by triggering various neural decision tree sequences. Strictly speaking, this model has not yet answered the question, what is consciousness, but they have provided considerable scientific detail about how consciousness works. It works by networked neural decision trees. For a biological organism, coming to recognize what an object is can be an important adaptation for survival. For example, it is crucial to know whether an object is food or some form of poison. Thus, a complex adaptive system of this type is essential, and it exists interconnected with many other crucial biological systems. Consciousness provides the mechanism by which these are all coupled. Before I share what I believe to be the third viable theoretical model about what consciousness is, we need to return to logical tautologies. You probably remember that logicians claim a tautology is true in all possible worlds. Its logical structure makes it true. However, we will need to give up this view to explain this third model. It is a quantum model. Logical tautologies no longer hold. One of the most important tautologies is of the form, either X is the case or X is not the case. One or the other, not both. It is the not both that we'll have to give up. Quantum theory says, sure both, and probably many more. A statement and its negation can both be simultaneously true. To be less abstract, consider the popular search for the so-called Himalayan Yeti. Lots of explorers have searched for it, but so far, there has been no luck in finding it. These many explorers scratch their heads and say, well, it has to either exist or not. They are thinking the way physicists thought before Einstein's relativity and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Today, physicists think of things from a quantum perspective. The Himalayan Yeti could both exist and still not exist. Maybe it switches from one state to the other state just to confuse the explorers looking for it. The Yeti's special joke that it likes to play. Quantum theory has had its most significant impact on the subatomic level. In the last quarter century, considerable progress has been made in understanding the subatomic world. The key insight to such work comes from quantum theory, more specifically, that a subatomic particle, say, an electron, is both a wave and a particle simultaneously. It is not one or the other. It is both. Which brings us to the third theoretical model about the nature of consciousness. Before we go too deep into it, we must add the caveat that it is both the most recent model and the most controversial. It is a theory that emerges from microbiology. Whereas the NCC approach described earlier was developed primarily using MRI and CAT scans of brain while a subject did something, this model studies quantum wave vibrations at the molecular level. Consciousness, this model posits, is directly related to these quantum wave vibrations. We now know that all atoms vibrate, for example, create waves. This includes those in our bodies. We now know that at the subatomic level, things behave differently. For example, according to quantum mechanics, an electron can be in multiple places at the same time. This phenomenon is called electron tunneling. It describes how electrons can pass through barriers that seem impossible for them to pass through. Furthermore, electrons can travel distances considerably further than would be expected based on their level of energy. To restate what I just said, electrons can be in places that one does not expect them to be. They can pass through barriers that should stop them, and they can travel unexpectedly long distances. Electronic tunneling has been well documented. It is the phenomenon that permits the ionization of atoms in strong magnetic fields. It also is a phenomenon that is frequently used in the various switching processes in electronic components. Knowing these subatomic effects, microbiologists have recently begun to explore how quantum wave vibration of various biological molecules behave. They have found that two common cellular materials display interesting effects that seem to be related to electron tunneling. The first cellular material that showed interesting wave properties were the hollow rods found in almost every cell called microtubules. Microtubules are made of tubulin proteins, and they are often being built, reconfigured, and rebuilt within cells. They play many important functions within the cell, including giving the cell its shape, structuring how cells divide, moving organelles around inside a cell, assisting the whole cell in locomotion, particularly with cilia and flagella, generating bundles of electrical activity. Most importantly for this theory, microtubules oscillate. Recent studies have found that their oscillations appear to be quantum, that is, they change from state to state as they oscillate. Researchers also believe that microtubules undergo electron tunneling, meaning that the electrons they discharge travel in multiple directions and may cover considerable distances. In effect, they say, the microtubule becomes a whole, an organized entity, not just a collection of individual molecules. One research team was specifically interested in why inert gases like xenon are effective as anesthesia, removing consciousness during surgery. They found, remarkably, that the xenon gas blocks the ability of the brain's microtubules to vibrate by filling the tube with the gas. Not only did the microtubules not vibrate, but they discharged no electrical signals. Thus, having no vibrations was directly associated with lack of consciousness. Another group of microbiologists studied a different cell component to discover whether it also had quantum wave oscillations. Ferritin is a protein that stores iron in a body's cells. It is most thought of as a principal component of blood cells. However, ferritin is also found in neural cells. In neural cells, ferritin acts as a storage facility for information. Its arrangement conveys information that the cell can communicate with other cells. More importantly, however, is that the researchers have confirmed that ferritin undergoes electron tunneling. Its electrons can travel in many directions and considerable distances from the particular cell that holds the protein molecules. The researchers view the ferritin as a signaling device, a sort of Morse code that transmits information to other neural cells, but it is not just one cell sending out its information, no. It is many millions of neural cells signaling each other. Most importantly, these cells are organized into hierarchies. Potentially, the ferritin molecules in a particular neural cell might be communicating electronically with millions of other similar cells. Since the system is quantum, ferritin molecules can have many different states at the same time. In a contemporary computer, there are only two states, on or off. In a coordinated system of ferritin molecules, there could be many states. Instead of just on or off, these quantum states could include red, blue, green, yellow, violet, brown, orange, magenta. The list could be lengthy. And then, the quantum states could be strong or weak, or even something like weak, a little stronger, just a bit stronger, pretty darn strong, very intense. Many hundreds of combinations of possible quantum states. Researchers have also recently observed ferritin molecules serving to switch or route information through them. Quantum molecular and submolecular wave vibrations represent an important locus for future study of the basis for consciousness. Tiny bundles of electromagnetic waves may well be instrumental in communication pathways within the brain. More speculatively, some theorists believe that the qualia of consciousness, for example, the subjective or qualitative properties of experiences, may be directly related to the plethora of relationships between various quantum oscillators. Like plucking a guitar string. Not just one string, but many billions of them simultaneously. In English grammar, the pronoun I and the pronoun me are said to refer to the same person. I remember hearing the presumed joke, I is me and me is I. English grammarians say that the pronoun I is used when the person speaking is doing the action. I run, I jump, or Descartes' favorite, I think. On the other hand, the pronoun me is used when the person speaking the recipient of an action. The action can either be direct, for example, the ball hit me, or indirect, for example, yes, the car was driven by me, not my dog. Nonetheless, I and me are said to have the same referent. Both pronouns are associated with the same individual. In other words, I equals me. There are times when I take action, and there are times when I receive information. Even though these functions can be quite different and may involve very different parts of the brain, there is still an equality. There is a single individual engaged in either function. The referent is the same. Me equals I, and I equals me. Expressed in that way, it seems to be a tautology. I do not think it is merely a linguistic convention invented by high school English teachers. I believe that the same individual engages in both functions, even though they can be quite different, the key notion is, I believe, is that the brain is an organized whole. It has multiple components, to be sure, but they are linked. Linked not as a chain, but as an organic, active whole. An integrated recursive system whose components work together ecologically to support and sustain each other, receiving and processing information, acting, then receiving, processing, and evaluating it, only to act again. A dynamic, integrated, recursive system. Me equals I, and I equals me. It seems tautological because the various brain components are fully integrated, a total unity. This discourse began with something that I had read in a magazine. The article said, "Brain waves spike during death." What then can we say about the I am during the process of death? I think it is the I am that flips the switch, which tells the rest of the system to die. It tells the other components to shut down, power off, cease all functions. And that is what is happening in the last burst of brain activity in the dying organism. The I am switches everything off.